kristenbark.com.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, with translators at 89.5 FM K208DG Galveston and 91.9 FM K220KC Huntsville. Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica radio station.
It is 5 p.m. Thursday, time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and it's only found on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I am Hank Rubicek, producer and tonight's host, and every week, with the help from the best team on radio, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on journeys through windows of their souls. Our winter drive has ended, and once again, the team from So What's Your Story thanks all of you who found a few bucks to throw our way. And to everyone in Houston and in our broadcast area, thank you for your loyalty to our show. You know, donations come in many forms, and it isn't always possible for even encouraged to pledge money we don't have. That's all right. Another time. We just want you to keep tuning in every week to bring the power of story into your homes. And it's not only the power of story we want you to remember. It's about promoting the creative expression Lewis Hill envisioned when he initiated Pacifica during the peace movement in 1948. We can't absolutely say anything we want on the air, especially if it's designed to tarnish the dignity of human beings. But within reason, corporations should not regulate the thoughts and ideas conveyed on the airwaves by citizens. This award-winning show, So What's Your Story, has been tagged as an icon in community radio for nearly 14 years. We've opened this storytelling stage to Houstonians of all ages, from 6 to 100, and that includes 6 and 100. Every storyteller from every walk of life is spotlighted and celebrated on this remarkable show, and although it's impossible to showcase pieces from stories delivered by over 500 tellers, I thought it might be fun to paint a story to picture on tonight's episode of a few story forms that were given less airtime over the years, and not because they were less engaging, but simply less common. In short, tough to find folks to tell them. For example, one of my co-hosts, Eric Heen, and I hosted a few police officers whose collective stories were, and there's no hyperbole here, astonishing. Tales that range from the simplest traffic stop gone bad to the anatomy of a murder confession. Serious stories. But how about a cop story that is seriously funny? Paul Bacon, a former New York City police officer, told this one at the Moth Center stage in 2020.
I used to work as a police officer here in New York City. I was a patrolman in Harlem at the 28th Precinct, and I worked the 4 p.m. to midnight tour. And at the end of one of these tours, I was told at the very last minute that I had another tour to do from midnight until 8 a.m. So it would be a double shift. This is the kind of thing that happened when you're a rookie. You always get the last minute crappy job. And so I got my patrol car, and I drove down to One Police Plaza, which is the police headquarters in downtown Manhattan. It's a large campus. It has lots of different security booths around the outside. And my job was to sit in one of those security booths all night, which sounds easy enough, but I was dead tired. And I also had I had a partner that I was going to be in that booth with the whole night. And we had two different meal times. His was at 2 a.m., Mine was at 3 a.m. so that there'd always be somebody at that post because, you know, we're basically guarding the police department at this point. And so there has to be somebody on there. And and also as to what constitutes a meal hour at 2 or 3 a.m., it's, of course, as you might expect, a sleeping hour. But that's totally prohibited. We're not allowed to sleep, but of course everybody did. And the punishment, if we were to get caught for sleeping on the job, it's a minor violation, but the job, they take away your vacation days. It's like the worst thing they could do to you when you're working as a cop, to have to work more as a cop. So if you're late one day, maybe they'll take one vacation day. If you get caught sleeping, you know, they'll take a few vacation days. And I imagined that getting caught sleeping when your job was to watch the fortress, I figured that would be like 5-10 vacation days. So when it came my turn to sleep at 3 a.m., I got in my patrol car and I just sort of parked in a parking lot that was next to the security booth down a hill and around a corner a little bit. And I found a slot between two other police cars, and I just parked in there. And I thought, you know, nobody's going to see me. This is going to be fine. I'm in the tall cotton here. Nobody's going to see me. So I'm going to try to sleep in my car, but I can't sleep in the front seat because I can't sleep sitting up. I've never been able to sleep on airplanes. So I figured, well, you know what? I can stretch out in the back seat. So I get in the back seat, close the door, lay down on my side, and I'm out like that, because I've been so tired, and I set my alarm for 4 a.m. But like I do sometimes, I woke up just a little bit before my alarm, and it was like it was a chilling revelation inside of a dream. I didn't realize until I dreamed about it, what I had done is I'd locked myself inside. Because this is the back seat of a police car, and I knew that what it's for, because I transported prisoners before in the back there. I know that we always have to let them out. And there are door handles on both sides, but they're purely decorative. And if my partner could see me, if I could get his attention, he could just come let me out. It's really easy. But he's close enough that I can see him and I can see what he's doing, but he's far enough away that he can't hear me screaming at him, and he can't even hear me banging on the windows. And I get my flashlight off my belt and I try to catch his attention, you know, just lighting up the side of his face. He's not seeing anything. Maybe he's sleeping too. Basically, he's out of the picture. So I think, well, you know, usually when I'm in trouble, I go right for my radio when I reach for my radio, but it's not on my hip. I left the radio in the front seat when I went to the back to sleep because I knew I was going to lay on my side. So I just took off my radio and my gun, and I placed them in the passenger seat. And I can see them. I can, like, look through the compartment. There's plexiglass. I can see my gun and my radio, the two most important things in my whole life right now, out of reach. And about this time, a Pepsi distributor truck pulls up in front of the parking lot. And I think, oh, this is great. I'm going to be safe. So when the driver gets out of the cab, I knock really hard on the window, and I get his attention right away. And he looks in my direction. Now, remember, it's really dark where I am. It's just like a darkened parking lot. And he doesn't see me. I can tell that, even though I'm making a lot of noise. So I take the flashlight again, and I point it like this. This makes the man very scared. And there goes my only way out, because he gets in his truck and he drives away. I can see I should have shined the light on my patch. Like, I'm a police officer, you know, on my shield, but no, on the face, it must have looked like a jack-o'-lantern. Never saw him again. And I didn't think I was going to see anybody else, because it was like now 4 in the morning. It's the financial district. It's Sunday. There's nobody out. So I do have my cell phone on my belt, and I pick it up, and I think, well, it'd be great if I had my partner's phone number up in the booth. Maybe I could wake him up with a little ringtone, but I just met him that night for the first time. I don't have his cell phone number. I can't call him in the booth because I don't know the booth number, because I don't work in this precinct. But I think maybe I could call my own precinct. Okay, up in Harlem, it's about 8 miles away. And I'd have to really sweet talk somebody into coming in and coming all the way downtown to come let me out of the car. And I know that if I tell anybody what's happened to me, I'm never gonna hear the end of it. Because I'm already a rookie, so, you know, you get a hard time just for showing up. And then I also happen to be kind of a liberal. And in the police department, you know, being a liberal, it's like it's impossible for you to do your job and be a liberal at the same time. It's like I'm a tailor with no hands. And I get a lot of flack for this, constant flack for being but I was a closet liberal, you know, that's what they were always trying to out me as a liberal, because I was always trying to hide it, because I just wanted to blend in. So I know I've already got these two strikes against me. So the third strike, they're getting locked in the back of the car. It's going to be forget about it. I don't even want to call the precinct. I'd rather just perish in the back of this car. And there is one number that I can call. And if I call this number, you know, it's going to be guaranteed somebody's going to come help me. But I never really wanted to call 911 as a cop. It didn't seem very professional somehow. But I have no other choice, so I call 911 and I let it ring, and I'm like almost thinking like, God, I hope they don't pick up, you know. But they do, I say who I am, and that I try to sound very calm. You know, I just need a unit to come to my location, just non-emergency, just one car, please. And she says, no problem, officer. What's your location? And I realize I don't know my location. A cop that doesn't know his location, that's, you know, it's really embarrassing. And because I don't know, because I don't work in this precinct and I can't see any street signs, but I can see that Pace University. I can see it, like I can see the logo on the wall. And I say I'm near there, and she says, that's fine. But one more thing, officer, I just need this for my report. What's your situation? I say, operator, I was hoping to not have to tell you that. Do I have to tell you? She's like, yes. And she's like, oh, wait, I know. And she seems to get it. She seems like she thinks she knows. She's like, oh, did you lock yourself out of your car? I said, no, I'm locked inside. And she laughs just like that. But immediately she's very genteel about it. She immediately puts me on hold, you know, so I don't have to hear her laughing at me. But the thing is when she comes back from hold, I can see, I hear other laughing. You know, I can hear a whole audience laughing. And she's obviously told everybody in 911. I envision this like high-tech room with all these operators with little headsets, and now they're all laughing about me. So I tell her, and she's like, don't worry about it, just relax. You know, I say, okay, fine. And then I hang up the phone. And I go, the hard part is over. You know, that was embarrassing. I think that's the worst of it. And then about a minute later, I hear a police siren off in the distance. And then another police siren. And I start to see flashing lights, you know, bouncing off of buildings. And I'm like, what happened? So I call 911 again, and I have to explain my whole situation. I'm that guy who's at the... And they say, please hold. And when they come back from hold, they say, oh, well, officer, your request for an additional unit was transmitted as a 1013. And a 1013, I say, that's the radio code for officer down. That's like a cop has a knife at his throat, or he's laying bleeding in the street and he's bleeding into the gutter. That's a 1013, not locked in the back of my car. And not only is this embarrassing because it's blown it up way out of proportion, there's no way I'm going to get away with this now, but it's really dangerous because cops driving around, coming to each other's rescue, that's their favorite thing to do. It's like the only thing they like about being a cop is when another cop's in trouble and they can rush to their location because there's nothing to stop them. They can just drive as fast as they want. And now this is all happening on my behalf. And I have this vision of like somebody getting killed or hurt. And the next day it's going to be on the cover of the Daily News and the Post. It'll be my ID picture next to some dead person. And I just think this is all going to be my fault. So I beg the operator, please call off the 1013. And she says she will. And then I hang up. And I notice that my partner in the booth, he's actually, all this activity has actually gotten him up. And he's moving around now. And he's coming down the hill. And I can tell he can't see which car I'm in because he never really paid attention to where I went when I left for a meal. So I take the radio off. Or I'm sorry, I take my flashlight off the belt and I shine it like I was doing it to before when he didn't see me. I'm like really trying to get his attention. And he takes his radio flashlight off and he shines it back. Gets to the point, walks down the hill, and it takes him 2 seconds. He just reaches down, lifts up my door handle. That's all I needed. And I'm free. But I'm not exactly in the clear yet, you see, because it's not for another 5 hours that I learn what my partner then tells me, which is that I'm not going to get in trouble for this. Nobody's going to find out, he insists. because he says the only person that's going to put you on report for this is your sergeant. And if you get in trouble, your sergeant gets in trouble for something called failure to supervise, right? So he's not going to get you in trouble. And as for your homies up in the 2-8, they're not going to find out either, because these cops down in this precinct, everybody knows. Now, everybody knows in the first precinct because it went over the radio. But he says they look out for their sergeant here. They really like this guy, so they're not going to tell him. And then, so when I'm in line to get my overtime slip signed out at the end of the night, where all the other cops are like, oh, I'm going to make so much money off this, I have to be very contrite and very penitent when I walk up to the sergeant and I hand him my slip. And he looks at my name and he recognizes it. Oh, that's the kid that was locked in his car. And he signs it and he goes, here you go, Bacon. You're a legend. And that's the only ribbing I get. That's the only ribbing I get, and I know that nobody in the 2-8 precinct found out, because I never heard about it. Because if I did, if one person found out, they'd all find out, and then they'd all dump on me, so they never find out, and they never will. Unless anybody here from the 2-8, from my old squad, I didn't think so. Okay, so my secret's safe, and that's my story.
You gotta love that. Gotta love that story. If you heard a little glitch, a little pause, by the way, it's because I had to pause a bit, because Officer Bacon opted to use two of the seven words we can't say on radio. You know, I had the good fortune of building a professional relationship with law enforcement when I was a negotiator for the Washington, D.C. Police Department in the late 1970s. I was a doctoral student at the University of Maryland. Better still, you know, indulge me as I tell you the same story that I told at the Moth Grand Slam a few years ago. I'll never forget that shabby little shack. It was 1979. I was a doctoral student at the University of Maryland teaching a class in crisis communication. One of my students came up to me after a class and told me his father wanted to speak to me. That was strange. I mean, why would a college student have his father speak to me? Well, it turns out that he was a sergeant for the DC police, charged with building a negotiation team. He heard what my class was all about, and those were the days when it was common for social scientists and law enforcement professionals to work together. Negotiator, I thought, might be a great way to get dates. You know, I mean, what's that thing on your belt, you might ask? And I would say something like, oh, that's a little walkie-talkie. I might be called upon to save a small village any time now. I had other jobs. I tended bar for the embassies. I modeled tuxes for iMagnum. I taught a little bit. So negotiator? Yeah, I guess I could see the connection. Well, I completed the training, but never really thought that I'd ever be called to a scene. I mean, how likely would that be, right? Well, it was on Christmas Eve, 1979, and I'm sitting in my apartment, and I get a call that I need to report to a mom-and-pop shop in a bad part of town. I'm also told that I'm to meet a Lieutenant Guthrie at the scene, and that there was a male, middle 50s, who had broken into the shop and took four people hostage. And he has a gun. Well, when I arrived, it wasn't anything like the movies. Not many police cars, no SWAT, no reporters. It was dark and eerie. And then I hear a phone ring in one of the police cars. The officer who was standing next to me answered it, and I heard a bit of his part of the dialogue. Yes, sir, he says about a half a dozen times. Yes, sir. Uh-huh. I understand. Then the officer walks up to me and says, you got to take this. Take what? I replied. This, he asserted. I remember thinking, I can't actually do anything. I'm an academic. Get someone else, I said, and he told me that Guthrie was called to another scene and that no one was available. He was called to another location, one more urgent than this one, I thought to myself. He's going to leave an inexperienced negotiator with a gun-toting crook in a room with four innocent people. Are you kidding me? Well, somehow, I mustered enough poise and courage to grab a megaphone, you know, the stuff of cheerleaders. Remember, this is 1979. Building rapport with a criminal by speaking through a cone from 20 yards away isn't easy. I learned his name, told him I wasn't a cop, had no weapon, and that I wanted to talk. Just talk. What happened today, John? What happened that caused you to do this? I mean, what prompted you to force yourself to break into a store and scare the hell out of four innocent people? He barked out a few things. He lost his job. He's a father and other indiscernible pieces of information. And I remember telling him that the media would be here soon. It was a lie because I had no reason to think this. I said, I can tell the media two things. I can tell them that there's a father who lost his job and broke into this place to be sure to have presents for his kids on Christmas morning, or that there's a maniac who's taken people hostage, causing them to wonder if they'll ever see Christmas morning. Which do you want me to tell him? After a pause, he yelled, get in here. The officer, coming close to smirking, looked at me and said, that would be you. I'm not going in there, I replied. That's your call, he said, but understand something. You don't go in there, he might go berserk and blow everyone away. Lots of thoughts came to mind, all hovered in guilt, more leveled at the officer than the hostage taker. I can't explain how I built up enough courage at all, but I felt guilty, and that was a part of the trigger, no pun intended. I felt I couldn't retreat. I wouldn't be able to live with myself. I just couldn't walk away. So I started to walk, one foot in front of the other. With my heart pounding so hard, I swear I thought it was protruding out of my chest. A lump in my throat was choking me, and I shook. I wanted to be drunk or stoned so I didn't have to think about what I was feeling. I even remember wondering what it might feel like to be shot. It was the longest 20-yard walk in my life. I opened the door, and I saw him immediately, gun in hand. It wasn't pointed at me, and he didn't look much like a criminal. That surprised me. First words I uttered, you scare me, I'm afraid, and I hated coming in here. And he answered, you know I'm not going to hurt her. You know I'm not going to hurt you. Well, while I'm pointing at the four hostages sitting on the floor, I did a little active listening and asked, well, are you going to hurt them? And he paused and said, no, I'm not going to hurt them. Then why are they here? I replied. I gestured for the hostages to stand, and I ushered them out the front door. It was a thoughtless move on my part, stupid even. He still had his gun in hand. And then he did something I never dreamed he would ever do. Put the gun on the floor, I asked him, and he did. We talked a while. And then I signaled to the officers that we were coming out of the shop together. The door was wide enough that we would allow for this, and I assured whoever was out there that our palms would be open. We headed directly into a blinding blue light. It was a fusion of fear and pride that got me through it. You know, Dr. Seuss, all the places we go. Well, this was a place I never wanted to go again. But on Christmas Eve, 1979, at about 11:20 p.m., I'm glad I showed up. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to So What's Your Story? Only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. You know, this show's proud sponsor is the Houston Storyteller Guild, and it's a terrific place to tell stories and meet the nicest people around. I know, I'm their president. We meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. The next story swap is March 22nd, so visit the Storyteller's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for the Zoom link to that swap and all our story swaps. And for information about upcoming events like our famous Liars contest held on April 30th. Now, this is a big deal. This is a big event. I mean, it's huge. And it's more fun than the law allows. And I'll bet you want to hear a great lie, huh? Well, here's Donna Ingham, one of the best liars in Texas, with a story called The Meandering
Up there in Terry County, my daddy liked to grow things. He did. He raised livestock, of course. Cattle, horses, bird dogs, guinea fowl. You name it, he'd try it. For crops, he raised cotton on the back 40 and alfalfa down in the draw. And every year, he had a big garden. There by the house, he'd plant tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers. And out in the field, he'd plant quarter-mile rows of field corn and black-eyed peas and string beans. That was in the spring. In the fall, he'd plant turnips. Every year, my daddy got his picture in the Brownfield News and Terry County Herald holding the longest cucumber or the biggest turnip. And one spring, he decided to plant some watermelons in between the corn rows. And not just any watermelons either, no, sir. He planted black diamond watermelons, the ones that are dark green on the outside and ruby red on the inside. Big-hearted watermelons they are. Oh, they are good. Well, your black diamonds grow big anyway, but this one particular melon got to growing bigger and bigger and bigger until pretty soon it was pushing out beyond the corn rows. It uprooted about a quarter acre or so. It got too big for Daddy to load in the back of the pickup and take into town to have his picture made with it. So he just called the editor of the newspaper and said, "You're going to have to come out here this year, boys. I've got something you've got to see." And they did. So there stood my daddy with his hand up on that watermelon. Oh, it was way taller than he was, and my daddy was 5'9" with his boots off. Then my stepmother got to thinking about what it was she wanted to take to the county fair that year in the way of canned goods. She didn't enter the baked goods, but she did love to can. Her corn relish had won the blue ribbon just the year before. Well, she got to thinking about those watermelons, and she had a real good recipe for watermelon preserves. So she decided to try her hand at that. She went up to the field to look over the crop, and naturally her eye fell upon that great big old melon that Daddy'd had his picture made with. She said to herself, "I wonder if that melon is any good. I reckon I'd better plug it and find out." Now, she had an 8-inch butcher knife with her, and she began to cut through the rind in a triangle shape like any good plugger does. But I'm telling you, the rind was so thick that when she pulled that plug out, it was all rind. There wasn't any melon meat on it. So she stuck her hand in through the plug hole, clear up to her shoulder. But still all she could feel was rind. Well, that provoked her some, and she took that butcher knife and kept hacking away at the plug hole until, before long, it was big enough she could step inside, aiming to get to the heart of that watermelon. You know, I think everything would have been all right if there hadn't been just a little slope to that field. But there already being some strain on the vine there, what with that big old melon on it, when my stepmother added her weight to it, it was just too much for that little old bitty stem, and it just popped right off. The next thing she knew, she was tumbling head over heels over head over heels inside the watermelon as it rolled down the slope out of the corn patch and onto the county road, taking out about a half a mile of fence posts as it went. And Daddy was over standing by the barn when he looked up and saw his melon rolling by. And he could hear his wife's voice from inside hollering, "The heart! The heart!" Well, he thought she was having a heart attack, so he jumped in his pickup, pushing the case of cannon jars he'd bought that morning at the Piggly Wiggly over to one side and got in behind the melon. The county road made a little banking turn there as it came into town, and it just kicked that watermelon over onto Highway 82, so now it was on its way to Lubbock, by way of Meadow, Ropesville, and Wolfirth. The melon was rolling right down the middle of the highway, forcing cars and pickups and 18-wheelers off into the bar ditch. It was mowing down mailboxes and Burma-shave signs. Daddy was doing his best to keep up. Meanwhile, police cars and ambulances and fire trucks were falling in behind him. There was even a traffic helicopter flying overhead. All Daddy had to do to get up to the minute reports was just turn on the radio. The runaway melon is approaching Lubbock at a very high rate of speed. It is headed right for the South Plains Fairgrounds. The midway has been evacuated, and the exhibits area is on high alert. Lucky for everyone concerned, the melon didn't quite negotiate a sharp curve in the highway going into Lubbock, and it bounced off into McKenzie Park, right in the middle of Prairie Dog Town. And no animals were hurt in this part of the story. There it was, rolling across all those prairie dog holes, and they must have acted just like hundreds of little speed bumps, because they sure enough did start to slow that melon down. So by the time it bounced on over to the South Plains Fairgrounds, it rolled to a stop, just as docile as you please, right in front of the food exhibits building. Daddy came to a screeching halt in the pickup and bailed out, still thinking his wife was having a heart attack. "Are you all right, sweet thing? Do you need CPR? Well, she came climbing out of that melon all red in the face and spitting seeds. "Now I'm all right," she said. "I just wish I had my canning jars, because I don't think I'm going to have time to get my preserves made and entered in the county fair." "Not to worry," Daddy said. "I've got a case of jars right here in the pickup. All you need to do is scoop out some of the heart of that watermelon and stir it up in those jars. You don't even need to add sugar. You know how sweet those black diamonds are. You'll win a blue ribbon for sure." She pulled herself up to her full height, brushed herself off as best she could, and did exactly what he said. And by doggies, she did win another blue ribbon. And I think the melon would have won a blue ribbon, too, if it hadn't had so many miles on it.
Okay, the meandering melon, y'all. That's Donna Ingham from her CD Tall Tales and Outright Lies. There's a lot more of that where that came from. You just have to go to www.houstonstorytellers.org to register for a fun night of lying a lot. Texas is some of the best tellers in the country. And don't take my word for it. Just join the Tejas Storytelling Association, whose festival is going on as I speak. And to take your skills to the next level, there's the National Storytelling Network that taps into tellers not only from around the country, but around the world. In Houston, our friends at The Moth are back at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy terrific narratives on a focused theme and meet what I know you'll find is a surprising number of storytellers in town. And they are nice folks. And hey, please visit our So What's Your Story at facebook.com/SoWhat'sYourStory and let us know if you have guests that we should consider. Or please text me, Hank, 832-277-1581. All that information is going to be on our Facebook page. Something that we'd like to explore on this show a little bit more is the story song. Oh, we've treated it some, but it's another form of story that we're committed to bringing to you on much more airtime. Now, there are a lot of examples of story songs, but here's a list of a few of the more popular ones, ones that I'm sure you've heard, or at least most of them. American Pie, Don McLean. you know, Chevy and the Levy, you're going to hear for 9 hours. Yeah. Tom Dooley, the Kingston Trio, a Big Bad John, Jimmy Dean, 16 Tons, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, Gordon Lightfoot, Cats in the Cradle, Harry Chapin, Ode to Billy Joel, Bobby Gentry, Bad Bad, Leroy Brown. How about I Fought the Law, Bobby Fuller 4, John Mellencamp, Jack and Diane, two American kids doing the best that they can. Essentially, a story song contains the same elements found in a story. A beginning, middle, and an end. A plot, a hero, and sometimes even a villain. Conflict, gotta have conflict. Intrigue, a tone, and a central idea. And it can all be a simple story. I mean, take a guy who's vacationing over the border. He meets a beautiful girl who entices him at a bar. Risky business because she's already spoken for. She's got a guy. Still, you go for it. Well, go for her. And why not? She keeps telling you to come closer because you're her kind of man. Who could resist? That guy I mentioned earlier, the one who's she's attached to, well, let's be kind. The less than honest woman who wants it all and manages to put you in real harm's way just showed up. So you hightail it through the window and vamoose. And while you're vamoosing, you overhear her tell him that he's her kind of guy. End of story. But how about putting it in a story song? Recently deceased Jay Black, called The Voice by his peers, and Rolling Stone, by the way, and Come a Little Closer, by Jay and the Americans, 1964. What do you think, boomers? That's music. That's a story song. American singer Mark Cohn took a trip to Memphis to overcome a bout of writer's block, wandering through its streets, visiting Graceland, stopping by a church, and grabbing a drink at a local bar. He returned to New York and began composing his signature song, Walking in Memphis. The lyrics are autobiographical and, like many favorite tunes, emerged into a story song. Now, along with those components of a story mentioned earlier, a story song, like any story, needs vivid imagery. And this story has heaps.
Put on my blue suede shoes and I boarded the plane. Touched down in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain. WC Handy, won't you look down over me? Yeah, I got a first class ticket, but I'm as blue as a boy can be. Then I'm walking in Memphis, just walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis, but do you really feel the way I feel? Saw the ghost of Elvis on Union Avenue. Followed him up to the gates of Graceland, and I watched him walk right through. Now security, they did not see him. They just hovered around his tomb. But there's a pretty little thing waiting for the king down in the jungle room. When I was walking in Memphis, I was walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis, but do I really feel the way I feel? They've got catfish on the table. They've got gospel in.
They've got catfish on the table. They got gospel in the air, and Reverend Green be glad to see you when you haven't got a prayer. Sarah wants you to join him as he revisits his trip to Memphis. Ultimately, the goal of every successful storyteller is to paint verbal pictures, the images that form the backdrop of the story. Singer-songwriter David Massengill joined us back in October 2013, and listeners loved this one called My Name Joe.
Joe threw another tantrum. He could not be understood. He cries like baby Samson. His English is not good. Oh, his English is not good. Joe's boss of the kitchen, but on the outside he knows the low man on the totem is wearing giveaway clothes. Wearing giveaway clothes. Joey fights the good fight. He wears a white uniform. The waiters are artists out chasing unicorns. Oh, chasing unicorns. Joe works 14 hours. After 10 he starts to booze. He gets very cynical. He sings the Buddha blues. Oh, he sings the Buddha blues. My name Joe. My name Joe. There is a king in Thailand, and he plays the jazz drums. He has a fine and healthy son. Oh no, I'm not the one. By the time clock, Joe is beaming from a photograph. Someone drew it across his face. The waiters began to laugh. Oh, began to laugh. Well, Joe picked up a hatchet and he tenderized the wall. When he got through with it, time clock wasn't punching anymore. Time clock wasn't punching anymore. Ran for cover. Maitre D began to kiss. The drunkard in the corner said his letters was not crisp. Oh, his letters was not crisp. Then the owner called immigration. He said, here's someone you should know. He's an illegal alien and a fool named Joe. Oh, I know his name is Joe. My name Joe, my name Joe. There is a king in Thailand, and he plays the jazz drums. He has a fine and healthy son. Oh no, I'm not the one. My name Joe. He said, I got a job to do. Easy questions, easy answers. Just point me to the kitchen crew. Point me to the kitchen crew. He has Leroy from Harlem. He has Cisco from Mexico. He has a white trash from Tennessee. They all said, my name Joe. My name Joe. My name Joe. My name Joe. Immigration man, he sputtered. The kitchen crew, they roared. Wow, they would argue. And Joe slipped out the back door. Joe slipped out the back door. Slipped out the back door. Echoes his own heartbeat and the distance he has sailed. Oh, the distance he has sailed. My name Joe, my name Joe. There is a king in Thailand, and he plays the jazz drums. He has a fine and healthy soul. love. Oh no, I'm not the one.
Haunchingly beautiful. You know, a point that we try to make on this show every week is that everyone is a storyteller, a natural storyteller. It's important to understand that we've got things to say. And unlike the metamorphosis that occurs to a butterfly or a frog, telling a story will probably not dramatically alter your character, physical structure, or even circumstances. However, as a storyteller, you can imagine it did. It's Hasidic wisdom. What's truer than truth? The story. A young man proved it to himself about being a storyteller when we engaged in a conversation not too long ago at a bar. Somehow, we began talking about the topic of regrets. Strange, I know, but a few single malts can inspire anything, I suppose. He told me that he recently moved here from Boston. He was a graduate student, and he lived in a large Victorian. And suddenly, he looked at me as if he wanted to tell the story, beckoning me to ask him to do so. And I did. I said, tell me about it. He said that he lived in a large Victorian with other people. And when he was unpacking, a woman, an elderly woman, came to his front door and knocked. And he answered the door and she said, excuse me, do you have any flour? And he says, no, I don't cook. And I just moved in, lady. I really don't have anything. I'm sorry. I have no flour. I've got nothing. I'm sorry. And he shut the door on her and she walked away and he continued unpacking. A few minutes later, the same woman knocks on the door, and she asks, excuse me, do you have any sugar? Well, he says, lady, you were here a few minutes ago, and I told you I didn't have any flour. I certainly don't have any sugar either. I got no flour. I got no sugar. I don't cook. So please, leave me alone. I'm really busy. Well, about a half hour later, he says, another knock at the door, same woman asks, Do you have any salt? He's getting a little testy, he tells me. He says, I'm a little upset. And I say, lady, please, I am really busy. I'm tired of you coming over here asking me things that you know the answer to. You know I didn't have any flour. I've got no sugar. I've got no salt. Please leave me alone. And he shuts the door on her. He runs out to do a few errands, he tells me. Then he comes back and he sees that there's a maintenance man on the third floor of this Victorian changing a window. He asks him, what's going on here? Why are you changing that window? And the maintenance man says to him, oh, there was a woman who jumped out of here about 15 minutes ago. Guess she was really depressed and she killed herself. That was the same woman who came to his door asking for flour, sugar, and salt. She was just looking for a friend, he told me, and I wasn't there. He paused and looked at me and smiled, took a sip of his drink, and said, I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to do that again. You know, not only was it a terrific story, well-sequenced, beautifully told, but it demonstrated how stories help us make meaning of things. We use words and gestures, we use symbols to express ourselves and all of those episodes in our lives and to learn things. Well, tonight, you know, just covered a few of my favorite things, or at least mine, I think it's mine, and items ripe for more airtime. So What's Your Story is an eclectic show, just like our city. And on this program, we've had children communicate their creative masterpieces. Clergy of every denomination render words of wisdom through folk tales and punctuated parables galore. Stories of loss, jubilation, mystery, magic, fear, and everything on the emotional wheel crafted in story form for Houston, for you to enjoy, to treasure, and ponder. On behalf of Mary Edgerton, Eric Hain, Larry Thompson, Tatiana Gago, Maddie Leonard, and me, thank you for tuning in and allowing us into your homes with a story, or 100 or so, in our hearts, every week. Don't you dare move, because Charles Hightower's R&B Gold is up next with a cool mix of soul. We want you to make Houston's community station, KPFT, a part of every day. Join us every Thursday at 5 for So What's Your Story? You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't really end well, it doesn't mean you can't live happily ever after. How about we close up shop with another story song by Jay and the Americans for your drive home? Crank it up and be safe. Peace.
Well, if you are an animal lover, then BARC, the City of Houston's Animal Shelter and Adoption Center, would love to get to know you better for two reasons. First, for fostering, as fostering changes lives. And there's many different options within fostering, but with every kind of fostering, the goal is the same, to help every foster animal become adoptable and to find a forever home. To learn more about the life-saving act of fostering, shoot an email to barkfoster@houstontx.gov. The second thing to know about BARC is the large number of adorable animals looking for their forever homes. BARC's Adoption Center is open from noon to 5 p.m. Tuesdays through Sunday and is located at 3300 Carr Street, which is near 59 and Collinsworth. So if adoption or fostering works for your household lifestyle, please seek out more information at HoustonBARC.com.
I am Susan, and one of the reasons I've made Houston my home is because of KPFT, after living all over the country. I'm something of a blues hound, and I think KPFT has some of the best blues programming in the country. Please join me in helping this station, which is a treasure for our ears, to survive and thrive. Please call 713 526
You're listening